This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the parents of a Black teenager shot dead by police in Oakland, California, speak out, and stop and frisk trials begin again in New York City.
But first, presidential competitors Mitt Romney and Barack Obama both went to New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel last week to have a few laughs at the Al Smith Memorial Dinner. But outside the hotel, doctors, senior citizens, and disability activists were not in a laughing mood because they believe that Medicare is threatened. We spoke with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal of Physicians for a National Health Program.
It's being threatened by both parties. Even the Democrats are talking about raising the age of eligibility for Medicare, possibly decreasing some of the benefits. It's definitely threatened. And then there's been a lot of talk about how it's bankrupt and it's a terrible crisis right now. We have to do something right now with the fiscal cliff. And I think that's all very misleading. It's not a crisis right now. It's not going to run out of money for a long time. And it's very easy to fix that. It doesn't have to run out of money.
We remember that President Obama, 2 weeks before he took the oath of office, said that Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid would all be on the table for chopping.
Right. Those were not reassuring words, were they? It's a very big problem, and as a member of Physicians for a National Health Program, not only do I want to preserve Medicare as it is, but since it's been such a successful program and it has made a huge difference in the poverty rate among the elderly, we think that it's a wonderful model for improving and expanding it to cover the entire population.
Have the debates so far made you more optimistic or pessimistic about the stance of both of these candidates regarding Medicare?
Well, I have to say that I'm very pessimistic because when even the Democrats are threatening Medicare, with all of the stuff in the media, it's sort of taken as a given. It's made the public think that that's absolutely necessary and that there's no choice, that this has to be done. I think it's giving the public misinformation. But when both sides are talking about making cuts, it's very, very discouraging to me.
You've assembled a pretty impressive coalition of folk, and you're treating Medicare not just in a defensive manner, that is, don't raise eligibility, don't make this program into a voucher, but you're also talking about expanding it to cover everyone, a kind of single payer.
Absolutely. When the whole health care reform was being discussed before the Accountable Care Act was passed, we thought, wow, this is a wonderful opportunity to really have a chance at getting a single-payer system for our country, which we think would be the best way to bring affordable health care to all. And we didn't have far to walk on how to do that because we've had Medicare in this country for 47 years, and it works very well. And so it's sort of a no-brainer that if we expanded it and improved it and gave it to everybody, that would be a huge improvement in the situation. But unfortunately, that message was not allowed to be heard on the media and even in Congress. We just couldn't get our message out because the forces of the very, very powerful healthcare industry would not allow that message to be heard.
And in fact, Medicare is hugely popular, and it crosses ideological lines. Even Tea Party advocates like Medicare. So those who would seek to weaken it claim they're trying to save it.
Right. It's really another use of the big lie technique. Weakening it is definitely not saving it. It's not as threatened as they say. And I think the side that wants to do that has been very successful in confusing the public and thinking that there's a crisis and this is the only way out. Even people who are very, very, very happy with Medicare, they don't even realize that it's a federal program. A lot of times when I speak to patients about wanting to have a single-payer system in this country, and I say, well, you know, do you like Medicare? And when they say, oh, no, that's socialized medicine, that's no good. I say, well, do you like Medicare? And they say, yes. They said, is that a government program? I mean, that's what some people said to me. It's just amazing. They just don't realize it. So even though it's very, very popular, there are people at the same time, they like Medicare, but they don't like anything. They say the government can't do anything right. They hold those beliefs both at the same time.
And you want to be very clear that this is not a partisan issue as far as you and your coalition is concerned.
Oh, absolutely. No, we, Physicians for a National Health Program and people like Healthcare Now and other members of the coalition, we want to adopt a single-payer, publicly financed, privately delivered healthcare system that is what is going to solve the problem of people not being afforded to go to the doctor. I mean, we're the only industrialized country where people become bankrupt from medical expenses. 60% of bankruptcies in this country are due to medical debt. And three-quarters of the people who were bankrupted by medical debt had insurance at the time of the onset of their illness. So health insurance does not equal health care. Even though you hear a lot of talk about the uninsured, an even bigger problem is the underinsured. So you can have insurance that's so skimpy that when you get really good and sick, it doesn't take care of you, and you have to use up all your savings.
But President Obama gives folks the impression that the days of bankruptcies based on bad health are over because of his Health Care Act.
Well, I'm afraid that that's not true. He made a big mistake. Instead of growing and expanding the public system, he decided to expand the private system. And that'll still leave people at the mercy of the insurance companies. It's true that they will have some of their worst behaviors curbed by the Accountable Care Act, but they still will have no rules about how much they can charge. They can still do a lot of their cherry picking where they... The reason why it's very bad to leave it in the hands of private insurers is because in this country we have for-profit insurers in health care. And how do you make a profit? You cannot make a profit insuring sick people. You can only make a profit insuring health people. So they do everything they can to avoid paying for sick people and just insuring healthy people. And they're going to continue to do that. So even though you may have a supplement to help you pay the premium, it still may be too much for you. If you look at what happened in Massachusetts, you go on their connector, which would be like what we're going to have in the healthcare market. When you look at how much they expect a person to spend for their healthcare, what percentage of their income, it's still under insurance. There's still many people who won't be able to afford the insurance.
And so by leaving the for-profit mechanism in, the ostensible main purpose of the president's bill to lower health care costs is not achieved either.
No, there's nothing in the bill that will definitely lower health care costs. It will bring insurance to more people. So some people will be helped, but there is nothing in it that will lower the cost. Nothing whatsoever. And it will still be beyond the means of many people.
We see that the overall cost of insurance premiums grew at a slower rate than in recent history. But many ascribe that result to the fact that people are seeing the doctor less.
That's true. People are seeing the doctor less because they can't afford to go to the doctor more. I had many patients who had to choose between going to the doctor or buying their medicine or buying food. They just simply could not afford all things. And I've also recently been working as a counselor for Medicare Rights, which advises people about how to navigate through the Medicare system. And even though Medicare is a whole lot better than not having it, it only pays 50% of medical expenses for the average elderly person because there's still co-pays and deductibles. And if we were to pass H.R. 676, which is the Medicare for All Act that's in Congress, that would take away these co-pays and deductibles, and people would not have these barriers to getting medical care.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal of Physicians for a National Health Program in New York.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations made its public debut in 2009 with a march and rally in Washington. This year, Black is Back returns to D.C. for a march and a national conference November 3rd and 4th. Aisha Fleary says the theme of the conference is Breaking the Silence.
For too long of a time, we as African people have
our issues swept under the rug, or it's not publicized, or a lot of people don't even know what's happening in the African world. And what that creates is a level of division because people don't see their problems as the same. And while there's bombs being dropped in Africa, not just Libya, while there's a growing and increasing number of U.S. military presence in Africa, while there is an increased militarization of our communities here in the United States, economic embargoes that are being put on African communities in the Caribbean and South America, we don't see that spoken about. So Break the Silence is highlighting all of those issues, that bringing people together so that we can try to solve these issues.
I would assume that AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, will be high on the list of discussion items.
Absolutely. As you know, Glenn, AFRICOM is a pawn in the U.S. game to control the resources in Africa through military, by continuing to train military forces in the continent to protect capitalist interests, but also as a way of setting up their resistance against the increasing influence of the Chinese on the continent. We're setting the stage for a sort of war between the U.S. and China, and AFRICOM being one of the major, major, major pawns in that game.
And, of course, U.S. troops won't be dying there. Africans will.
And that's always the case. I mean, millions of people have died in the Congo in the past 10 years, unless there's, like, focus groups who are focused on making sure people are aware of the cold hand and the reason for rapes and murders of African women and babies and men. You don't really hear about it sweeping under the rug, the deaths of African people, because that's never really on anyone's agenda.
And in fact, the United Nations has just issued yet another report laying the deaths in the Congo, the ongoing genocide there, at the doorstep of Uganda and Rwanda, who are the United States' firmest allies in Black Africa.
Yes, that collaboration that the international community has with the continued genocide of the people in those areas.
Do you think that we are at the verge of repeating the kind of proxy wars that occurred in Africa during the 70s and 80s with the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union?
Since the Berlin Conference and the imperialist powers splitting up the continent, there has been a missing voice of the African people themselves from the equation. It's always been this kind of war over property, and Africa, of course, is the property. And so right now it's a commodity that China wants, that China is getting more of an influence on the continent, and that the United States is trying to keep under wraps because of its failing economy and all the growing economic capacity of the continent. So I definitely believe that this is going to be a repeat unless we raise the view, the lens on what's happening and increase the knowledge of the people, of African people, of what's going on.
Black is Back wants to break the silence on unreported attacks on Africans worldwide, and that includes in the United States, the location of the largest prison gulag in the world.
Half of the prison population of 2.4 million, almost half of that, 1 million, is African people. So here we have a new kind of slavery, enslavement. Now, we have it outside on the streets as well when we're talking about economic opportunities, but that's also leading into the population count of these prisons. And then, of course, when you are in these prisons, you are working for corporate interest. And so there needs to be a lot more discussion about what are some of the reasons why this happened, and really pointing out certain parts of the society that would lead to something like this happening. And of course, it all is based on capitalism and imperialism and being a colony, African people being colonized within this country.
And of course, all but forgotten in terms of the Black political dialogue are the political prisoners, some of whom have been prisoners for two generations.
Here we have people who stood up saying they want freedom and liberation and self-determination for their people. Here you have people who took it upon themselves to fight, to struggle against an oppressive system, to allow many of us
to get some of the leeway that we have right now, only leeway because we don't really have full rights as oppressed people in this country. Whatever we think we have can be taken away just like that. But they put in a struggle, a determination, an honorable struggle, that if you ask any African person, any oppressed group right now who has a political prisoner in prison, they will tell you that these people are held up in the highest regard. However, because of the nature of this system, because of the continued onslaught that is happening against oppressed people in this country, those people still rot in jail, and they need to be let out now.
And in your statement on the Break the Silence activities on November 3rd and 4th, you say, we will disavow the charlatans, poseurs, and sycophants who've been chosen by our oppressors as our leaders. What did you mean?
Obama is one of those posers. A lot of our people in this country have been immobilized by the fact that somebody is now representing them who happens to sit in the seat of imperialism. And we are going to, in this venue, highlight, put out all of the reasons why he is a poser and why he is not good for the African community. But not just only that, there all over the world are black faces, people who say that they are working in our interest, are neocolonial stooges that continue to work not in the interest of African people, but serve the interests of the ruling class. And so in this form, we're going to put it out there on Front Street, again, breaking the silence and putting out the very factual information about what their reign means for the lives and self-determined nation of oppressed people around the world.
Aisha Fleary of the Black is Back Coalition speaking from Washington.
Trial begins this week for 4 of 13 people arrested in Queens, New York. Last year, in the campaign against the city's notorious stop and frisk policies. Carl Dix is a leader of the movement and one of the defendants.
4 of us who were part of the campaign of civil disobedience to stop and frisk last fall that Cornel West and I issued a call for, gone trial in Queens, New York. We face 2 years plus in jail for protesting stop and frisk. Ironically, we are in the same courthouse before the same district attorney's office that could not or would not put on an effective prosecution against the cops who fired 50 bullets at Sean Bell and his friends and murdered Sean Bell. So this DA, who could not effectively prosecute those killer cops, is piling charges on 4 protesters who were protesting stop and frisk.
What do you mean, piling on charges?
Here's what I mean. At first, there were 2 charges. Then 10 months after the arrest, he added on an additional charge, doubling the time faced from 1 year to 2 years, without citing any additional actions that we took. It was like the same actions that they arrested us for and charged us twice for. They just threw a third charge in, slicing and dicing it to increase the penalty. Then the trial was supposed to open on October 9th. The prosecution walks into court with an amended charging sheet, adding acting in concert to the charges without even having informed the defense that he was making this change. The significance of this is that if you add acting in concert, if you can find that any of the defendants broke any law, then you can convict all of the defendants of that because they acted in concert. They were working together. And to justify this, the DA went to mob cases where people had committed murder, involved in drug dealing and racketeering, and these were his precedents, the precedents that he cited to justify adding this charge onto us.
That sounds like a classic perversion of the racketeering statutes, and as if the prosecutor is turning this into a political trial. But you always considered it to be a political trial anyway.
Yes, it was definitely a political trial from the beginning. What we feel has to be on trial here is stop and frisk itself, because to me, it's not only illegitimate, unjust, and racist for the NYPD to racially profile black and Latino youth, to treat them like criminals out on the street under stop and frisk, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. It is also illegitimate, unjust, and racist for them to put us on trial in court for racism. And we want to bring that in. The judge has already let us know that that's going to be a fight, because he says this trial is not about stop and frisk. It's about, did you engage in disorderly conduct by not dispersing when the police ordered you to? Did you block access to the police precinct? And see, this is especially ludicrous because when we marched up to the police precinct in Queens, the police had already barricaded the precinct. No member of the public could get anywhere near the police precinct because they couldn't get past the police barricades. Then when we marched up, they opened the barricades and let us in and then closed them again so no member of the public could get in. Then they arrest us for blocking access to the precinct. I mean, this is just, on its face, it is ridiculous. Then for them to add on these charges, it shows that they want to deliver a message through this case, which is that anybody who stands up against the injustice of their criminal justice system will pay a heavy price. So they want people to look at that and say, I better not do the kind of stuff that those people did. Well, we want to put this on trial in court and also in the court of public opinion, because we want to send a different message. We want to send a message of the injustice, illegitimacy, and racism of this NYPD policy and the whole legal system that it is a part of. And that when people stand up against it, many people will stand with them in opposition to this injustice. And in fact, that we can beat this legal trial. So we're going to work to bring out to the jurors, even over the objections of the prosecutor and the judge, because we've already seen ample incidences of the judge coaching the prosecutor, you know, letting him know, here's how you should go about adding charges against these people. You shouldn't do it like that. You should do it like this. Don't you want to do this? It's not going to be the defense against the prosecution. It's going to be the defense against the prosecution, with the judge playing free safety for the prosecution and trying to keep us from going downfield against them. But we think that even in that situation, we can bring out in the court of public opinion and in the courtroom itself to the jurors what the real injustice is.
And this trial begins right on the heels of a national day of protest, which kicks off on the day of this broadcast.
Yes, on October 22nd, it will be the 17th annual National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. I'm going to be one of the speakers here in New York, but this day is going to be marked in cities all across the country. It's going down in New York, in Atlanta, in Houston, in Cleveland, Chicago, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Seattle, Washington, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and a lot of places in between that I neglected to mention, but are going to be in the house on that day too, because this has become the day to bring together resistance to the official abuse that police and the whole criminal injustice system brings down. It's the day that the family members and loved ones of police murder victims, survivors of police brutality, have a platform to tell the truth about what the enforcers of law and injustice have done to them and their families, and when people throughout society come together and have their backs. So this makes it a very important day, and one that people need to support, because what we have seen is a continuance and an intensification of the police brutality and police murder that has been going on, particularly targeting blacks and Latinos, for decades, a continuation of the justification of those acts as justifiable homicide and necessary brutality. A lot of people were telling me 4 years ago this was going to stop when we got our first black president. It hasn't stopped. It hasn't slowed down. It has intensified, so our resistance has to intensify. And it is noteworthy that as all this goes down, none of it even gets mentioned in this political election that's supposed to set the future direction of the country. In other words, whoever goes to the White House, blacks and Latinos are going to continue to disproportionately go to the jailhouse, be shot down in the streets and brutalized by those who are sworn to protect and serve.
And yet this item is missing from the agenda of much of organized black America.
That's true. Much of organized black America not only are missing in action on this political battlefront, if you pose this as what people need to deal with, sometimes you get jumped on for diverting attention from getting Obama a next term. You know, people want to be like, well, you can't raise this because it makes him look bad. Well, look, I don't care about how the Democratic president of the United States looks. I care about the people who are being brutalized and murdered and crushed by this system here in this country and around the world. And I got to call it like I see it, both in terms of resisting that brutality, but also speaking about the source of that brutality and the role that various people play in facilitating it. And frankly, you, the President of the United States, and you presiding over this brutality, you are at the very least facilitating its going on. And in Obama's case, he's very directly doing that by getting people out of opposing it for all kinds of different reasons. You know, his no excuses speeches talk about the real problem here is the young men who won't pull their pants up, the parents who won't turn off the TV and make their kids do the homework, his talk about absent black fathers not dealing with the fact that the system that he's now presiding over has taken a lot of those black fathers and warehoused them in prisons, and that's a big part of why they're absent, that it is not their fault, it is the fault of this system, and we need to put the blame where it lies and build struggle on the basis of that true assignment of what's responsible and who's responsible.
And I suspect that many of these organizations and preachers, if President Obama is reelected, will be no more enthusiastic about combating police abuse of black citizens on the streets.
Well, that's my expectation, too. But I know I am going to be very active in doing that. And there's a certain receptivity to that because there's been a rise in resistance on this front. And we have to continue working at that and not let things get sidetracked, not let the plug get pulled out of this, which some people are trying to work at pulling the plug out of this rising resistance. We have to take things like the call inside the prisons now for people, prisoners of different races and nationalities who've been at each other's throats, are talking about a peace treaty among them. That needs to be brought out to the streets where youth who are fighting each other because they might be black or Latino or because they might be in different street organizations begin to realize that if you're a Crip, your enemy, your problem is not the Bloods or MS-31. Your problem is the system that is oppressing and exploiting all of y'all. And y'all need to actually get together to deal with that common problem as opposed to fighting and killing each other. We got to work on those fronts because there's an increasing receptivity to that. We got to work to see to it that that resistance gets built. And myself, I'm going to be working to build it as part of a movement for revolution because for me, on the real, it's the capitalist system that's the problem and revolution is the solution.
That was Carl Dix. You can learn more by going to stopmassincarceration.org. On May 6th of this year, 18-year-old high school student Alan Bluford was shot 3 times in the chest by an Oakland, California police officer named Miguel Masso. At first, the cops said they had been in a shootout with the teenager, but soon the police story began to fall apart. There was no shootout. Bluford wasn't armed, and his parents are calling it murder. We spoke with Alan Bluford's mother and father. First, we hear from Geraldine Bluford.
This is what the sergeant came out and told us the day of the shooting that my son was in a gun battle and that he had shot the officer twice. And that story lasted a couple weeks, maybe 2 to 3 weeks, until we got the ballistics report, and my son had no gunpowder, no nothing. He had never shot a gun, period. And so they came out with that initial story, smeared it all over the news. They were saying a man, suspect. They never said it was a student, 18-year-old guy. One of my biggest problems from the beginning is my son was leaving. I gave him some money. He put it in his wallet. He carried his wallet. He was employed by the Oakland Unified School District as a cafeteria assistant, where he made like $8 an hour, helping prepare the food, helping the disabled with their cafeteria trays, cleaning up, that kind of thing. And I saw his Skyline High school ID. When I was trying to identify whether that was Allen or not, they kept saying there was no ID. They didn't know who it was. We have until this day to find out what happened to his ID. So they acted as if they didn't know who he was, but one of the young men that was with him that night was in the back of the police car. He was one of the men that had been harassed. Actually, he was 15 years old. So it was 2 18-year-olds and a 15-year-old. And they said, oh, he heard over the loudspeaker. The officer's partner said, do you know who he was? They said, 18-year-old. So I don't know what happened to a school ID. I don't even know why they, you know, they just came up. So that was the initial story, the gun battle. And then when we found out that he never shot a gun, never shot the cop, that was the one. Then they came with, he pointed a gun. And so they just changed the story. At least, we've heard about 5 or 6 different stories.
And in fact, there's no evidence of your son that night engaging in anything that one might call criminal activity. It seems like it was just a teenager out to meet some girls with his friends.
That's exactly right. I have my husband here, Adam, Mr. Ford.
Good afternoon, Ford. This is Mr. Adam Bluford.
Good afternoon, sir. You also didn't get very much cooperation from the coroner's office.
No, we didn't. We actually got a summarized coroner's report. We didn't get no actual notes from the coroner and no pictures and stuff like that was turned over to us.
We had to file a suit with attorneys to even get the coroner's summary.
Yeah, we actually held a press conference in front of there a few months after my son's murder, and they came up with the summary of a coroner's report in which we was charged $321.
So after all of this history that Oakland has, and the city police force being put in a kind of receivership, and everyone links in their minds police brutality and Oakland as if they're one word, they are still stonewalling on your son's death.
They're not only stonewalling, they seem to want to justify it. My son was chased a mile, fell to the ground, and stood over and shot in his chest 4 times with a .40 caliber weapon, and this officer is blaming him.
And they still have no allegation of him having committed a crime.
Well, he hadn't committed a crime. Earlier on, they were saying through stories that Oakland Police Department released a statement saying they were they looked like 3 guys suspected of a burglary earlier in the day. And then the story changed to, we thought these guys had drugs or a weapon. Neither two looks the same. So it was just a racial profiling at its core. So they seen the 3 young black men, accosted them for no reason at all, other than thinking that they had something that they shouldn't have had because they were black and walking down the streets in Oakland. He rode up on my son and his 2 buddies, and lights off, guns drawn, rode up on the other side of the street, lights off, jumped out, guns drawn. Grabbed one of the young men that was with my son, handcuffed him immediately, started to give him rough treatment. At that point, my son jumped up and ran. He chased my son a mile, 5 city blocks around corners. Yeah, it was 11:45, close to 12 o'clock at night. It was Cinco de Mayo night after the fight. I just spoke with my son 15 minutes before this incident, telling him that Oakland is not a good place to be. I don't want him over there, and that you know, he needs to come home. He said, okay, Dad, I'm okay. I'm just chilling in a white Chrysler with some girls. I said, all right, man, well, you need to be getting home. He said, okay. And that was about 11:30. There's two stories we're hearing. There was a Cinco de Mayo party where my son stopped at. There was approximately 15 witnesses out in front of this house where my son stopped. These witnesses are giving conflicted statements to a certain point. There's only one witness there saying he sees our son shooting a weapon, which is untrue because my son was tested and was never shooting a weapon. So they're using that witness as the witness that said my son had a weapon. But all the other 14 witnesses said my son didn't have a weapon. My son was on his back on the ground when he was stood over and shot three times in his chest. They say my son's last words was, I didn't do anything. 7 out of 11 witnesses say they heard my son scream, I didn't do anything. And 2 of the witnesses said, my son said, why did you shoot me? And Maso's first words to the arriving officers who arrived on the scene was, I swear he had a gun, and I've been shot.
And this is the horror of the situation, that the logic of the police racial profiling is death, no matter what the victim does.
There's a bunch of crazy details surrounding my son's death. Actually, earlier in that day, there's a local revolutionary black group called Yeru House that's based in Oakland.
Uhuru.
They held a mock trial, putting Oakland Police Department on trial for the murder of Lavelle Mixon. That was the young man who murdered the 4 police officers in Oakland. They had a mock trial for him, and they went down to the city of Oakland the same day my son was murdered, just hours before, and tried to subpoena the chief and a few more officers for that court, which a few of those people were arrested. They marched down in the city of Oakland attempting to lift up Lavelle Mixon's name. Approximately 4 hours later is when my son was chased down and murdered.
The meaning that you draw from that is that the police were in a mood, angry at having been demonstrated against and called names, and they were out there that night taking it out on other young black men.
That's what I'm getting out of that, Mr. Ford. I'm thinking that they were probably on the edge that day because it could have been friends of theirs that was murdered, and we don't condone no police killing or anything like that, but we think that that played a part in my son's murder that night.
We also read that Oakland cops are now less inclined to beat up on people because of the past history of restraints on the department, and they use their weapons more.
Yeah, so we hear that they shoot and ask questions later. I'm getting back to the Lavelle Mixon thing. Since that unfortunate incident, the police is really on the edge with young black men. They feel like they've been vilified so bad in our area since the Lavelle Mixon incident that they are really on the edge and they're really willing to shoot on young black men without hesitation, for nothing, actually.
And yet it really does make sense to run away when cornered by these police because they do mean to do you some harm.
Yes, they've been noted to plant stuff on people, to jump on them, to beat them. And actually, Miguel Massa was charged in New York. Before he came to Oakland, he was charged in a federal claim that him and 3 other officers beat this man almost to death, tasered him, kicked him, maced him, and the guy was almost died in a cell in New York. A federal lawsuit was filed by, his name was Rafael Santiago, and he filed a federal lawsuit. And Mouser was also the officer in the claim that was the officer who denied him medical treatment for hours that almost caused this guy to die. He was named as the officer that was one of the coldest officers. He was also the officer who helped beat him, but he was named individually as the officer who denied him medical attention in the lawsuit. That lawsuit was settled out of court for $50,000 they gave Rafael Santiago. Mouser left New York 12 days after that claim was filed to come to the Bay Area.
How is the community responding to this latest outrage, the one that claimed your son's life?
The community has been responding in a positive way, thank God.
They're outraged and upset. They are really, you know, Oakland Police Department is, it may be under federal receivership, and a lot of the community is in agreement with that because they're tired of the abuse and the way that Oakland Police handles their, you know, how they're handling things and how they're treating the community, especially our young black men. And a lot of people are now in agreement that they should be turned over to receivership by the federal government, because within the city, they don't try to bridge the community and the officers. They just shoot first, ask questions later.
And we've been getting support from our local unions, our SEIU, the local Longshoreman Union. They're just getting on board. This all happened in the last week or so. We've been speaking to them. So
the
Local 10.
The Green Party.
The Green Party. We've been getting this awareness out, and we are definitely getting support from our community.
And I know Geraldine Bluford is taking this national.
Yes, she is. We're actually going to New York, Philadelphia, the East Coast next week. I'll let her speak a little more on that.
Yes, as I told you before, we'll be speaking in Philadelphia. We'll be speaking at Carleton College in New Jersey, and also at the Riverside Church in New York, where we have been in contact with Romali Graham's family, the young man who was killed shortly before Allen. As mothers, we have been supporting each other and standing in solidarity with one another, being the fact that our 18-year-old sons are now gone, ripped and robbed from our families, just torn apart. And so we'll be there. We're trying to gain national support so that, you know, we could make people aware of what's going on in our communities and make the young men aware, you know, talk to them and let them know, you know, not to give up on their lives. I've been talking to a lot of the youth who are saying, you know, why plan for the future when I might not live until, you know, past 18 or even before 18? And a lot of mothers who are just distraught by tragedies of losing children or police brutality. Another young lady tell me about how the police beat her sister. I mean, it's an epidemic. It's genocide against our youth, and we have to do something to stop it.
That was Geraldine Bluford, and before that, her husband, Adam. Parents of 18-year-old Allen Bluford, killed by Oakland, California police.
Members of the South African grassroots movement called Abalali Base Jandolo are on a speaking tour of the United States. In the Zulu language, the name means people who live in shacks. The organization represents many of the nation's shantytown slum dwellers who feel marginalized by the South African government. The slum dwellers are speaking out in solidarity with the country's miners, 34 of whom were massacred by police at Marikana this summer. We caught up with spokesman Nikelo Ndabankulu in Chicago.
As an organization, we felt we need to take a stand against the killing of mine workers by the police, simply because we believe that what the miners were struggling for is just and is also guaranteed in the Constitution of the Republic, and there is no justification of killing them, no matter what. And we also knew for a fact that the crime they committed is a daily crime which our organization do and the country do on daily basis, because in South Africa, each and every after 3 days, there is a protest, simply because there is lack of consultation, there is lack of respect by the authorities against the citizens, which always force the civilians to protest on daily basis. And if we would allow that as a nation, for police to shoot and kill protesters randomly, that would mean we are already dead, because South Africa is a protesting state. So if police are allowed to kill protesters, that means the whole country will be left with no citizens, because the police would have killed everybody and the country would be left only with the rich people and the police only. And then we condemn that killing and would not accept it, because we only understand that the police used to kill and shoot protesters during the apartheid regime, because we were not allowed to protest, and the systems and the laws of that time allowed the police to do so. So it's surprising when the police of the apartheid regime will react on protesters in a shoot-to-kill way, and also the police of the democratic regime will react in the same manner in which the apartheid regime police used to react against protesters. So then we found that is an attack on our constitution as well as on our democracy.
In your statement of solidarity with the Marikana mine workers, you say that you face the same system that makes some people rich and others poor. That's not what you expected to develop at the end of apartheid.
Yeah, we are quite by surprise by now, simply because during the apartheid era, especially the black people were victims of the apartheid system. Unfortunately, after the liberation, then the poor people were victims of the same of the democratic system, whereby you find that the rich people are getting richer and richer and the poor are getting poorer and poorer. Whereas when we're fighting against the apartheid regime, we had one slogan, which was to fight for a better life for all. And unfortunately, now we only have a better life for few and the rich, because in the apartheid era, the better life was for the white people and the black people were victims. And this thing just turned around in the liberation time now, whereby if you are rich, you are respected and you are advantageous. If you are poor, whether you are black or white, you are on the disadvantage and the receiving end of the oppression and the disrespect by police and authorities. So we want the government to change the attitude and to fulfill and respect the Constitution of the Republic and the Freedom Charter of the leading party, which states very clear that the wealth of the country should be shared amongst all the people who live in the country. And also, South Africa belongs to all who live in it. But unfortunately, you find that if you are a poor citizen in South Africa, you are treated like as if you are a half citizen.
Many people in the United States are aware of the killings at Marikana, but your movement has also had its martyrs.
The only problem with the mainstream media is that they will only report when there's a massive killing of people. But fact of the matter is, people are killed in South Africa on daily basis when people are protesting. But unfortunately, the media doesn't report if there's one poor man killed. They will only report if there's a massacre and a big number of people. And then we condemn that because we believe that every life counts. So whether it's one person or two people or three people or 20 people, these things should be reported because there is no life which is worth killing, especially on the hands of the police, which are living on the taxpayers' money. And their role is to protect the citizens of the country, not to kill them.
You seem to be saying that the African National Congress, the ruling party in South Africa, has made a deal with the devil.
When we look at the ANC of today and the ANC of yesteryears, there's a big shift because The ANC were the pioneers and the defenders of human rights. But now, when the ANC is in power, we find there is a lot of human rights violation, and the ANC looks like as if now is talking left and walking right, because the police attitude is also instigated by the politicians from the ANC. If you can remember, the former police commissioner was calling upon the police to shoot to kill, and then which was really an attack on human rights, even though we don't accept people to kill the police, but for politicians to call upon police to kill the people, that's also not right, because the police's responsibility is to make peace in the country and to protect the civilians. But for the minister to call on police to shoot and kill, with an intention to kill protesters, that's not fair to the democrats and the constitution of the republic, because there are a lot of measures that police can use to disperse crowds, like water cannons, rubber bullets, not like ammunition, like as if we are on war.
You're now on a speaking tour of the United States.
We hope we'll be able to make a lot of international networks so that when there are human rights violations in any country in this world, the whole world must condemn that. Because we believe that we managed to overcome the apartheid government because we had a lot of international solidarity. So we believe and hope that we'll make a lot of international friends in the USA and in the other countries worldwide. And also, as South African grassroots movements, will also be available to offer solidarity for poor folks in America who are also violated, because the issue of human rights violation is not only in South Africa and Africa, it's happening all over the world. So we are prepared as South Africans to offer political solidarity for every citizen in their country of origin who are facing human rights violations.
What kind of reaction do you expect from the regime, especially since those killings at Marikana? Is it going to dig in its heels or negotiate with folks like you?
They are not willing to negotiate with us, but what we're going to do, we will force them just like how we did during the apartheid government, because the apartheid regime didn't want to engage the liberals, but because of the force that we put onto the apartheid regime, they were forced to negotiate and allow democratic process to take place. So even now, our government is reluctant to negotiate and to listen to us, but if we remain organized and remain united and become a strong force, they will be forced to listen to our grievances. Because even the Marikana situation, at last, the Marikana workers managed to get the increment, even though it was not the target which they were willing, but at least they get the increase.
Nkelo Ndabankulu of the grassroots South African organization, whose name translates as people who live in shacks.
The tempo of protest is rising in Haiti, where a U.S.-backed government faces increasing popular opposition. Glenn Ford has this commentary.
The people of Haiti are in motion, and the U.S.-installed government is responding with tear gas and bullets. Demonstrations have erupted across the country, denouncing the regime of Sweet Mickey Martelly for corruption, demanding jobs at livable wages and the basic services that states are supposed to provide, and calling for an end to the 8-year occupation of the country by the United Nations. UN soldiers took over from U.S. Marines after Washington's coup against the democratically elected president Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004. Since then, Aristide's party has been effectively banned. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton holds no public office in his own country, but he rules like a viceroy as the UN's special envoy to Haiti. The country's been reduced to a kind of protectorate of the UN, which, for all practical purposes, translates as a colony of the United States. Because Aristide's Lavalas party was excluded from the voting, most Haitians did not even go to the polls in April of last year, allowing Sweet Mickey Martelly to win the presidency with the support of only a small fraction of the Haitian population. That means politics in Haiti is mainly the politics of the street. And the streets of virtually every large Haitian city and town have been alive with demonstrations in the past few weeks. Teachers in Port-au-Prince demanded a living wage equivalent to $1,200 a year. Slum dwellers in Cité Soleil protested deplorable conditions. In Fort Liberté, residents demanded a shipping facility. More protests are planned in Cap-Haïtien and the capital city this week. Haitians and their supporters demonstrated last week at the United Nations in New York, asking the UN Security Council to pull its troops out of their country. Instead, the Council voted to extend the so-called peacekeeping mission for another year, although the force's size will be reduced. One of those that met with UN peacekeeping officials was Haitian Senator Jean-Charles Moisey. At a meeting in a Haitian neighborhood of Brooklyn, Moisey said he understood the game that's being played at the UN, but will continue to insist that foreign soldiers be withdrawn, that security be turned over to an enlarged Haitian police force, and that reparations be paid to the families of the 5,000 Haitians that have died from cholera introduced into the country by UN troops. Senator Moisey is known for riding a white horse at anti-Martelly demonstrations. He says the liberation of Haiti does not depend on the United Nations, but on the Haitian people. The whole country is standing up, he said, so I had to come into the street with the people. You have to be with the people when they are in motion. Then the senator rushed to the airport to rejoin the protests. Bill Clinton and the multinational corporations he represents have other plans for Haiti. Clinton says Haiti's greatest advantage is its low wages to better attract foreign capital. In other words, Washington's goal is to keep Haitians desperately poor so that they'll take any job at any wage. but Haitians are determined to win back their national sovereignty and set the terms of their own development.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.